From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, we'll be looking at incarceration in America. Over 2 million Americans are currently in prison, meaning that the U.S. has by far the highest incarceration rate in the developed world. My guest today is Richard Dudley, a founding member of the Commission on Safety and Abuse in America's Prisons, which issued a report last year highlighting the significance of incarceration on public health. Today, we'll be looking at the features of life in America's prisons that have long-lasting impacts on the health of both prisoners and the society as a whole. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Today's news update was compiled by Public Health Radio's news director, Andrew Coates. There appears to be a crisis in the availability of dental care in both the United States and England. A survey of patients in England conducted by a government commission found that 1/4 of British patients were unable to find a dentist within the National Health Service. 20% had stopped seeking dental care altogether because of the high cost of care provided by private dentists in Britain. 1 out of 15 individuals had treated themselves, for example, by extracting their own teeth. Private dentists in England are able to charge at least double what dentists within the National Health Service can charge. Meanwhile, in the United States, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released new data that there has been a sharp decline in dental health in America between 1999 and 2004. The number of people in the United States with untreated cavities, as well as the number with no teeth at all, rose sharply. In the 2003 to 2004 survey, 27% of American children and 29% of American adults were reported to have untreated cavities. Similar to Britain, there also appears to be a problem in the U.S. in the number of licensed dentists available. Since 1990, the number of dentists in the United States has remained constant, while the population has grown by 22%. The report also points out that dental care is generally unavailable for poor children in the United States. The report is available at the website of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, cdc.gov. The International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, the group which won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985 for its work in opposition to nuclear weapons and nuclear war, sponsored a study on nuclear war, which was released earlier this month. The study estimates that 1 billion people would perish in the event of a limited or regional nuclear war. Famine and infectious diseases were estimated to be major contributors to the death and illness after a regional nuclear war, and would greatly compound the disastrous direct devastation wrought by the nuclear explosion's immediate effects. The authors estimate the effects of sudden atmospheric cooling and make use of data from historic periods of famine and contagion in human history. The study used contemporary population density and food supplies, as well as data estimating agricultural production potentially lost due to the direct effects of radiation. Dr. Ira Helfand presented the study earlier this month at a meeting of the Royal Society of Medicine in London. Helfand points out that large-scale nuclear war, for example between the U.S. and Russia, has become universally feared as a potential global catastrophe. But the new study warns that any war fought with nuclear weapons, even a so-called limited nuclear war, holds grave potential for widespread human catastrophe. The report is available at the website of the Physicians for Social Responsibility, psr.org. Coming up next, the state of healthcare and health in America's prison. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. The United States has the highest incarceration rate among the 35 wealthiest nations, about 6 to 8 times higher than the average for the other countries, and one of the highest incarceration rates in the entire world, even including the poor countries. On any given day, 2.2 million people are incarcerated in the U.S., and over the course of a year, many millions spend time in prison or jail. 750,000 men and women work in correctional facilities, and the annual cost is more than $60 billion. Yet, within 3 years, 67% of former prisoners will be rearrested, and 52% will be incarcerated again. More Americans are sent to prison, and once in prison, they're likely to remain there longer than individuals in other countries. Incarceration is especially frequent among African Americans. At current rates, a black male born today has about a 30% chance of being imprisoned during his lifetime. Alarmed by the steady rise in the prison population in the U.S. since the early 1970s, a multidisciplinary group of individuals met and decided to undertake a systematic study of imprisonment in the U.S. The group, consisting largely of individuals and funding from the private sector, met and formed the Commission on Safety and Abuse in America's Prisons. The commission began gathering information in the year 2005, holding public hearings, taking testimony, accepting letters and electronic mail, convening focus groups, studying model programs, as well as visiting small and large prisons alike. Those testifying included researchers, prison staff and management, former prisoners, family members of prisoners, mental health professionals, prison rights activists, and many other interested parties. Finally, after gathering data for over a year, the commission issued a report last year. The report, entitled Confronting Confinement, will be the focus of today's show. The report can be accessed online at the commission's website, prisoncommission.org. My guest, Richard Dudley, was one of the founding members of the Prison Commission. Dudley is a practicing psychiatrist in private practice in New York City. A portion of his practice has been devoted to forensic psychiatry. He also serves as an associate professor of medicine and director of the Department of Behavioral Sciences at the City University of New York Medical School. In addition, Richard Dudley is an adjunct professor at NYU Law School in the area of forensic psychiatry. Richard Dudley, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to maybe start out by maybe laying out the big picture of how many Americans are actually in prison, what our incarceration rate is, maybe how it compares to other countries.
Well, we have about 2.2 million Americans incarcerated, and our incarceration rates are higher than any other comparable country.
Comparable country, you mean developed countries or
developed
more than that?
Yeah. Any other developed country.
Are they much higher? How does this compare?
Dramatically higher. We're much more likely to punish through incarceration. Over the last decades, we passed legislation that have resulted in longer and longer sentences. And so we now incarcerate for periods of time that are just astonishing to people from other countries. I mean, things that we consider to be kind of you know, average periods of incarceration would be considered very long for other developed countries.
Might this partly because we have a bigger problem with crime? Do we have more vicious criminals, or is that really not the reason?
No, that's not the reason at all. I mean, it's just we just really handle criminals differently. We seem to be a country that's more, that has more of a belief, or at least our practices would indicate that we have more of a belief that incarceration is the answer and a way to punish crime. And then again, the length of incarceration, particularly for nonviolent crimes, is so much longer than any other country. And they keep getting longer.
And do the other countries pay a price for this? Does our system, where we're punishing people for longer periods of time, does it seem to help by reducing our rate of committing further crimes?
Well, not really. I mean, like, there's no indication that we have less crime than they do, than other countries have, and that our approach to incarceration has had an impact on crime. It's clearly had an impact on our economy because we spend so much on incarceration, much higher percentage than other countries do.
It looked like after gathering all this information and taking all this testimony, it looked like the commission ended up concluding that there were perhaps three or four areas that were especially important problems that they identified by taking all this testimony and doing all this research. And one of the ones that it seemed to be at or near the top of the list was the issue of violence.
Yes.
And its impacts on both the correctional officers and the prisoners, and ultimately on society. And I would like to have you talk about why violence, you're a psychiatrist, and why you think violence in prisons is so important.
The thrust of the work of the commission was to look at safety and abuse. And so clearly when you think of it in those terms, you know, violence jumped right to the top of the list.
And when you say violence, what types of violence are you talking about?
We're talking about everything from homicides to other sorts of just assaults, either prisoner on prisoner assaults, guard on prisoner assaults. We're talking about sexual violence, you know, rape in prison as well, so any sort of physical violence.
I presume that all these forms of violence are common enough to be a big problem, but maybe not equal in all the different prisons, I assume. That.
Yeah, there certainly are differences when you go from prison to prison and jail to jail, and there's also been differences over time. I mean, it looks like when you look at the data, while violence is still a serious problem, homicides, say, for example, have gradually decreased over the years, but assaults, it's been more difficult to measure, and sexual assault, sexual violence, of course, continues to be a problem as well.
So why is the issue so important from your point of view?
The part of the question is well, prison, yes, is punishment, that we think of it as punishment. But as I indicated, 95% of people eventually get out. And the question is, you know, kind of what happened to them while they're there? And do they come out either traumatized or more violent as a result of having lived for those years in a violent environment, or do they come out more ready to be integrated into and repatriated with our society? Similarly, what happens to the men and women who work in prisons? Do they spend their day in a violent environment and then take that home? And what impact does that have on them as individuals? And what impact does it have on their families living day to day in that kind of environment? And so when you're looking at things like domestic violence, not only domestic violence in the lives of corrections officers or others who work in prisons, but then the domestic violence that occurs when individuals are released from prison having lived in a dangerous and violent environment, or other sorts of trauma-related syndromes from being a victim of violence or seeing people killed or seeing life-threatening violence on a day-to-day basis. And those are the impacts that we're concerned about.
You pointed out that the data on non-fatal violence, in other words, assault that does not lead to death,
right,
that the quality of data are poor. Is it actually known whether prisons that manage to achieve lower rates of violence, that the prisoners actually do better after they're released and are less involved with interpersonal violence?
Well, there's clearly some evidence that the violence that people experience in prison, you know, has an effect on them, not only while they're in prison, but upon their release. And it's also very clear that the violence that those who work in prisons experience has an effect on them in the sense of making their job more stressful, and also that it has, you know, kind of spillover effect on what happens to them at home. We heard lots of testimony about that from ex-prisoners and corrections officers. The studies bear that out.
The report seems to place a strong emphasis on the role of prison administration and guards, and that they can have a very big impact, that it's not just the particular prisoners that ended up in that prison that inevitably are going to act violently, that the report seems to indicate that there are many things that prison administrators, those who run prisons, can do to minimize violence. So can you tell us about some of those strategies? What seems to work?
Just kind of go back to your actual question, because I think that's an important point. You know, the presumption that, well, prisoners are violent, so therefore there's going to be violence. Everything that we saw, everything that we heard, all the studies that have been done have shown that it's a much more complex picture than that, that kind of what happens and how the prisons are run can make a big difference. Some of that does have to do with exactly how the prisons are run, and some of it has to do with kind of funding and other sorts of issues. So, for example, one of the big issues is overcrowding, and that if you're jamming more people in there's overcrowding, that seems to increase violence, which has to do with just kind of how many people are being sent to prison and how much space there is, you know, which is not something that those who are running the prisons can control. I mean, that's a factor that's controlled from the outside that they then have to come to grips with. Similarly, an issue is, well, do people have anything to do? In an attempt to deal with the increasing numbers of people in prison, the monies that would have been previously used for programs, you know, whether it's educational programs or training programs or treatment programs or whatever, much has been diverted just to deal with general housing and feeding people because the money's been needed there. And then in many jurisdictions, funding for programs have just been otherwise cut. And so the fact that you have a population who has nothing else to do, who are just idle, that also has an impact on funding. So both of those on violence. So both of those issues, in a way, are outside of the control of the administrators. But then in addition to that, you have kind of what goes on with the way the prison is run. Is there leadership that creates a culture in which there's a striving for some sort of mutual respect between prisoners and guards? Is there leadership that will not tolerate excessive use of force by guards? Those sorts of issues, kind of what the relatedness is between the prisoners and the guards, excessive use of force by the guards, those things also have an impact on the level of violence in prison. Whether policies and procedures are clear, whether people know what to expect, whether they're treated fairly and consistently, all of those things have an impact on violence. Those things are under the control of those who actually run prisons.
You mentioned the importance of treating prisoners with respect. I would bet that there are people who feel that you shouldn't do that, that actually part of the punishment is to not treat the person with respect. If they wanted to be respected, they shouldn't have committed the crime. But it sounds like you don't feel that should be part of punishment.
Well, I think
that the prison sentence alone is enough, and people should, once they're in prison, should be treated with dignity and respect, whatever. That's your position.
Yeah. You're stripped of your rights and your freedom as punishment, and you are then incarcerated and confined. That doesn't mean that you should be otherwise abused. That doesn't mean that you should be allowed to suffer from health care problems. That doesn't mean that your mental illness should go untreated. That doesn't mean that you should be allowed to be assaulted and raped or stabbed or whatever. being treated as a human being, punished though you may be, is part of what creates an environment that is safer, safer for prisoners and safer for those who work in prisons, and in turn, ultimately safer for the community at large when prisoners are released and when those who work come home.
Now, a few other things that the report mentioned was they came out very strongly in favor of surveillance technology.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering why that they viewed that as important.
We looked at a variety of things that have been done to decrease violence, and in addition to the kinds of things that I've already mentioned, the use of surveillance technology so that what goes on can be monitored, and not only the behavior of prisoners but also the behavior of staff, has clearly been shown to make a difference. And so that administrators and those who run prisons and state policies for behavior and are trying to develop a culture that doesn't tolerate violence can know when it occurs, and that individuals who are incarcerated or working in prisons know that everyone will know when it occurs because it can be seen.
Now, one of the other emphases of the commission's report was the prison administration ought to do all it can to maintain and support the link between the incarcerated individual and his or her family and community.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could discuss that a little bit and how that can best be done and why that's so important.
Well, again, I think a lot of the testimony that we had, as well as all the studies that have been done, have shown that when inmates remain connected to their families and their communities, that gives them a purpose, helps them maintain hope, helps them think about planning for the future and moving on with their lives when they are released. And it keeps alive the notion that, you know, their life is not totally defined by this period of time in which they're incarcerated. And all of that has an impact on their behavior and how they see the incarceration experience, including an impact on violence. But unfortunately, in so many states, if not most states, prisons are located in rural areas far away from where the majority of prisoners actually come from. And in bigger states, that makes it extremely difficult, if not impossible, for family to visit and maintain real personal contact and interaction with inmates. And
well, let me just say that can be even worse than what you've just described. In Vermont, we house many of our prisoners in Kentucky because we have more prisoners than we do prison beds.
Right.
So we've taken it to an even greater degree of separation. It would
right.
undoubtedly be very difficult for those people to visit.
Right.
And we're
so
told
to be out of state placement is really, you know, is an even bigger problem.
And these are not neighboring states. It's
right.
Kentucky, which is
right.
quite far. And we're told that the costs are lower. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on what the full cost is of implementing a policy of that degree of separation from family.
Well, even those jurisdictions that have their prison in some remote rural area of the state talk about the cost benefits of that from the standpoint of, you know, less expensive land, less expensive employees, etc. But what's not measured is the increase cost overall to citizens of the state, to the extent that losing that contact and individuals coming out then not connected, you know, not supported by families anymore that they've lost contact with, not having the benefit of the support of their families even while incarcerated to keep them focused, to keep them help keep them geared towards planning for the future, etc. Well, what's the cost of that? So we are not calculating into that equation the fact that, you know, an individual is released, they have no place to go, they have no family to help support them and help reintegrate them into society, and of course that contributes to their eventually returning.
And they even mentioned that phone calls are an issue. There are prisons that allow virtually no phone calls or charge very high rates.
Right.
and especially for prisoners that are housed in a distant location, it would seem like that would be quite counterproductive.
Exactly. I mean, I think all forms of communication with family, whether it's phone calls, I mean, sometimes some have policies even about mail and how they want to handle mail and whether mail is going to be opened or not. And like you said, phone calls. Sometimes it's visiting hours are so restricted that, again, I mean, when family has to travel across the state to see somebody and they're only allowed an hour, they have to be almost overnight to be able to get that. I mean, it just becomes kind of impossible.
Are there examples around the country that you might have encountered in which prison administrators actually actively help families to visit? Because many of these people are undoubtedly poor, the family members,
exactly,
and might not own a car.
Well, we saw two things. We saw many jurisdictions where they have a policy of sending people to prisons closer to their home when they're just about to be released. Thereby kind of accepting the notion that as part of the reentry process, you know, kind of hooking up with your family again is a good thing. And so that they are essentially facilitating visits by relocating them for about a month or so before they get released. You know, the problem is that with such long prison terms that we have now, when you've been inaccessible for years, often relocating them at the very end is not helpful. So there's the notion of even amongst the options of where you could house people, could you make decisions to house individuals in at least prisons that are the most readily available to their family instead of sending them to the farthest possible place you could send them to. And there are jurisdictions that are trying to do that now.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guest today is Richard Dudley, and we've been discussing the public health impacts of incarceration in the United States. After the break, we'll look at the importance of prison health services and also the special impact isolation has on prisoner health and strategies that prisons can use to improve the health of prisoners and the community that surrounds prisons. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. The United States has by far the highest incarceration rate among the developed nations and one of the highest rates in the entire world. On today's show, we've been discussing the impacts of America's prison system on the health of prisoners and on society at large. Our guest is Richard Dudley, a psychiatrist, faculty member at City University of New York School of Medicine, and an expert on the psychological impact of prison life on public health. Now back to the interview.
The commission emphasized the importance of health services in prisons. And I was wondering if you could describe some of the issues. And I have to say the one that caught my attention first was the very high rates of communicable illness. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yes, clearly one big concern was the high rate of communicable illnesses. And I think amongst the studies that we looked at, it looked like more than 1.5 million people are released from jails and prisons each year carrying life-threatening communicable diseases.
Give some examples.
let me back up for a second here. I mean, we're talking about a couple things. We're talking about how, again, many prisoners are poor, with poor medical care anyway, right? Before they even come into prison. And then if they come in with infectious diseases, that's one issue. They're at increased rate, of course, catching infectious diseases because they're confined in a population with other people who already have them. And if they're left untreated or poorly or mistreated, the infectious diseases, then you end up with treatment-resistant strains, you know, running through a prison. That creates then even a more serious problem. So even things like staph infections could end up being serious if they remain untreated or they're poorly treated and you get kind of resistant strains. Then there's other things like TB or HIV that could be running rampant through prisons as well. And so the risk, of course, is not just to the prisoners themselves. The risk is to their families and to their communities when they're released. The risk is also to those who are working in the prisons and to their families when they come home in their communities. And so these infection running through the prisons are not at all confined to the prisons and very readily end up getting transmitted to the communities around the prisons and the communities to which individuals return home.
Earlier we spoke about the importance of reducing violence and how common violence is in prisons, but I noticed in reviewing some data and preparing for this interview that suicide rates in prisons are actually far, far higher than homicide rates.
That's right.
So I have to assume that that's the tip of the iceberg of a setting where there must be a great deal of mental illness. And you're a psychiatrist, so give me your thoughts on the overall picture of mental illness in prison and why it's come to be the way it is.
Well, I think there's a couple factors that have contributed to that. Certainly one is, as you know, over the last decades, that we've closed large state mental health facilities in most jurisdictions, and we have not matched that with an increased in community-based mental health services to service that population. In other words, we've released people from state mental hospitals, really because we have medications and therapeutic interventions now that should be able to maintain them in communities without being in state mental hospitals. But we haven't provided those community services, and so that people, instead of being treated differently or better in less restrictive settings, are not receiving treatment at all. And many of those people are ending up in jails and prisons because they're not functioning. As a result of their mental illness, they get into some sort of trouble, and they end up in prisons and jails.
And what are your thoughts about the relationship between dependence on narcotics and other substances of abuse and incarceration of those individuals with those problems?
That's a whole other population. I mean, that people who have substance abuse problems in and of themselves, and people who have a combination of substance abuse problems and other mental health problems, where the substance abuse problems may have started as self-medication, but then becomes an additional problem to their other mental health problem. So you have both populations who represent a significant body of those who are incarcerated. And this is a perfect example of what we were talking about earlier, that we keep passing laws that increase the incarceration rate of people with substance abuse related difficulties and then increase the amount of time for which they're going to remain incarcerated. And so I think we have to ask ourselves at some point, is that the best way to spend our money to try to address this, or are there community-based treatment programs, could they be more effective for less money?
The fact that this was highlighted by the commission implies that this is a very major problem in prison. So overall, what percentage of individuals who are incarcerated, what percentage of the total population actually have serious mental illnesses?
Well, it's in part depends on how you define it. We're talking about, you know, 20% or so people with serious mental illnesses, but most of those studies are talking about people who have psychotic disorders, you know, people who have major mood disorders. And they're not including necessarily people who have other significant psychiatric difficulties, even though those significant psychiatric difficulties may have contributed to the behavior that got them in prison in the first place. So, you know, people who have who've been traumatized in some way, people who have a variety of other sorts of anxiety disorders and things like that, or aren't really included in those numbers. So if you think about people who have diagnosable psychiatric disorders, the percentage jumps up much higher than that.
But you're saying a minimum estimate for severe mental illness would be something like 1 in 5 prisoners. When I reviewed the report of this prison commission, there was one story that a mother of a prisoner told that I thought was particularly poignant, and I'd like to just read you the little quote and get your reaction to it. And here's this woman telling her story about her son who's in prison. She says, "My son's 20 years old, has been incarcerated most of his legal adult life due to drug problems, thefts, and mental illness. David has been in the Department of Corrections for several months and has only written one letter. And he simply stated he was in a psych ward and that he loved us with all his heart and soul. I keep writing him. I've written him many times. I get no response. I attempted to visit him a few months ago and was told that David refused to allow me to visit him. I've heard through an inside contact that a disturbing situation occurred, and I'm not sure, it may have been my son. And that incident involved a man in the same unit who was screaming, playing in his feces, obviously having serious mental health issues. And because he was screaming, the goons, apparently that meant men dressed in black, came into the cell and beat the man and hosed down the cell. Soon after the incident, the man was reportedly taken away to another area. This incident reportedly occurred in Housing Unit 9, and my son was in Housing Unit 9. And then, after that period, he was transferred to Housing Unit 5, which is also called the Hole. I called the Department of Corrections to ask about this and was told to speak with a case manager, but I never seemed to get through to a case manager or to talk to the same person more than once. The psychiatrist can't tell me anything because of some confidentiality statute. I'm a nurse, and I don't think David is mentally competent to make a decision to not allow me to visit. I think it's too easy for mentally impaired inmates to be abused and hidden from family members by putting the inmate in some hole and simply state that the inmate's refusing visits in mail. I don't know if this happened to my son, but I feel some inmate in there it's probably happening to. I don't know what to do about this. It's scary and it's disgusting to me to think that there is a chance that this has occurred." And the story goes on, but what are your thoughts about this type of story, Richard? Is this going on in the U.S.?
We heard stories like this, not only from this letter that was written to the commission, but from others as well. As we've already discussed, I'm a psychiatrist. I do some forensic work myself, and so as I go into prisons to evaluate people, sometimes a connection with a particular case. And of course, plus I've worked with this commission. And I'm certain that that sort of thing goes on, and it goes on far too frequently. And that sort of thing is really several things. It's mentally ill people not getting treatment and being allowed to suffer their mental illnesses when those illnesses are treatable. It's also mentally ill people being punished for behavior that's a product of their mental illness that they can't control, so that instead of getting treatment, they're punished for it and put in segregation or in isolation or in some sort of hole and left there to suffer with the symptoms of their illness. It's also a matter of what we were talking about before. Instead of facilitating contact with family members, which could make a difference for every inmate and certainly could make a difference for an inmate who is ill, often the contact is not only not facilitated, that policies and procedures and ways that the prison runs or visiting hours or communication mechanisms, having to pay for telephone calls or scanning, opening mail, or whatever the policy may be, actually makes communication with families even more difficult. So I mean, she raises really a series of problems that do in fact occur in many prisons that she's describing coming together and possibly affecting her son. When this kind of occurs with somebody who is even has a known mental illness before they go into prison, as you pointed out earlier, the age of so many individuals who go into prison, their early 20s and their 20s, also happens to be the age period in which many of the most severe psychiatric illnesses first manifest themselves. And so some of these men and women go into prison with no prior history of psychiatric treatment, and their illnesses, in other words, the crime they committed may be around the time where they're first beginning to have psychiatric difficulties, so they don't have a history of treatment at all. And when those psychiatric difficulties are not identified as part of the whole process through which they end up in jail, then it's even harder for them to be identified and treated than it is for the people who come in with a known and established history of psychiatric treatment.
Now, what was the impression that you and other people who were on this commission that studied these prisons, what was your impression about the quality of health services available to treat both physical and mental illness among prisoners?
What we found was is that there were some very good examples and some horrible examples. At one extreme, we found prisons that really did not, for example, screen for some of these infections, and therefore people were not treated, and therefore, you know, and the infection was a real problem within the prisons and within the prisoners and within the staff who worked there. That we found situations where people who known chronic illnesses came into the prisons and the ball was dropped, that those chronic illnesses were not treated, who were on medications on the outside for chronic illnesses, and therefore they became more severely ill. And therefore, when medical services finally were provided, they had to be, of course, much more expensive services because the person has medical status had deteriorated so much that they required a different level of intervention. So we found all sorts of lapses in the delivery of medical care. And, of course, saw jails in which there have been such enormous lapses in the delivery of medical care that court cases had been done and courts or whomever had taken over now the supervision of the medical services in some of the jails and prisons because the care had been so bad. At the other end of the spectrum, we saw some very exciting examples about how to deliver medical care in prisons and how to conceptualize prisons and jails as part of a larger community, recognizing that the health status of prisoners and those who work in prisons and jails affects the health status of the larger community. So we saw places where people were staff from local community health providers rotated through the prison and identified people from their communities in the prisons, provided their health care there. That way they were hooked up. So when they were released, they knew where the local provider was. They already had a relationship with them. They could continue their care upon their release. Where, in other words, community health services were very fully integrated into the prison health services. And the continuity of care was good. The quality of care was good. And people received care that was at least consistent with maintaining a larger, healthy community.
And what about the issue of care of mental illness, since, as you pointed out earlier, it's so very common in prisons? Are there enough psychiatrists and psychologists to meet the need?
Oh, no, not at all. By just looking at the numbers, and you can look at the numbers of the severely mentally ill, how many of them need inpatient psychiatric beds, how many of them need kind of the next level of care where it's maybe not fully inpatient psychiatric care but some sort of full-day program just to stabilize them, you know, and get them stabilized on medication, that those facilities don't exist in the numbers in which they are needed. In other words, there aren't enough beds amongst the prisons to treat the number of patients who need them that they know that they have. And there's not enough psychiatrists and psychiatric nurses and psychologists to treat them. So even for the most severely ill, there's just inadequate staff and inadequate facilities to handle them. For people who are kind of the next tier, who have major psychiatric problems, which require treatment, in order for them even to function in jail, let alone to help them be able to function in society when they're released, most prisons and jails don't even try to offer therapy, whether it be individual or group or whatever, to help those individuals address their psychiatric problems and prepare to function upon their release from prisons and jails.
So these prisons find it cheaper to just dispense psychiatric medication?
Yeah, they give medication to those who need it, and little more than that gets offered in the way. Not only, I mean, I'm not talking about whether people are getting, you know, kind of on the couch 5 times a week analysis, but even just psychotherapy aimed at helping them identify and address the problems that they have, or even psychoeducation programs helping them to understand the nature of their illness and the importance of taking medications upon their release. In addition to that, you know, you have the whole issue of, again, going back to this other problem of if the prisons are located far away from the cities where many of the prisoners actually come from, then you're going to hire medical staff who are living out there as well. And that may be not so much of a problem, you know, when you're hiring an ophthalmologist, but it may be more of a problem when you're hiring mental health professionals, because it becomes critical that they have some understanding of the culture of the individuals whom they're treating, if they're going to be able to engage them, if they're going to be able to understand them, if they're going to be able to work with them. And so it's not just a matter of inadequate numbers of mental health professionals to treat those who are incarcerated. It's also trying to find mental health professionals who are culturally competent and who, in working with the different populations of individuals who are incarcerated.
Many prisoners are in the age group between 18 and 35. And among people who are not incarcerated, that happens to be the age group where large numbers of people have no form of health insurance. Among men that age, well over a third have no form of health insurance at all.
That's correct.
And the commission report emphasized very strongly that they really thought that requiring payment or co-payments for the medical care that the prisoners needed was really something that needed to be abolished, and they really felt that prisoners should be cared for free of cost. What are your thoughts on that?
It was pretty clear that the prisons that have instituted co-payments, that it's been in part a political issue where a legislature has kind of felt that we're spending all this money for health care for prisoners, and yet there's other people out in the community who also have, like you said, who don't have insurance. And so that a prisoner should at least make co-payments. But, of course, prisoners, many of them don't have a way of generating an income out of which they can make a co-payment. And they're in an environment that is more unhealthy even than they were when they were in the community because of the confinement of it. And like we talked about before, the high rates of infections and communicable diseases, etc. And so that co-payments become a disincentive to seek treatment even when you think you might need it. Then in the long run, what happens is people don't end up getting treated until they're much more seriously ill. And again, that means that treatment costs much more than it would have if they would have been able to obtain treatment much earlier. And so that it really doesn't save money to discourage people from coming in for treatment. Along the same line, the commission looked at this issue of people who were incarcerated who, prior to incarceration, had become eligible for Medicaid or Medicare benefits as a result of their chronic illnesses, be they psychiatric illnesses or other medical health problems, who were on different sorts of disabilities and things like that, and found that virtually virtually everywhere, people lost those benefits upon incarceration. And so that the prisons and jails didn't have the benefit of being able to receive those payments to help with the cost of health care in prison, even though those individuals had qualified for those benefits before. And so in a variety of ways, the financing of health and mental health services in the prisons became a focus of concern for the commission.
So it sounds like your overall attitude toward this issue of inequality between the access and the financial barriers to medical care, the inequality between what prisoners face and what young people in the community face, that it sounds like you would just want people in the community to also have access to care. You don't want to deny it to prisoners.
Right.
Another emphasis.
Well, I just want to restate that, I mean, I think that there are two issues. One is, I think that everybody has the right to health care. But I also want to restate what became just so increasingly clear to the commission over the months of our work, is that by denying health care to prisoners, you're not simply punishing and hurting them, that it has implications for the society at large because they come out ill, and those who work with them come out ill. And so that you really are not just hurting them, you're hurting us, you're hurting all of us.
Another emphasis that this prison commission developed had to do with segregation and isolation of prisoners.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could lay out why that issue is so important and what kinds of things you think ought to be done about it.
What we found was how we had this ever rapidly growing prison population that we talked about already. And what we found was also happening was that the percentage of those incarcerated who were in segregation of some sort was growing as well. And so that we're now having just overwhelming numbers of people who are in some sort of segregation.
And what exactly does that mean?
And what I mean is that they are being separated from other prisoners. And in many cases, that means that they are locked down in their cells 23 hours a day, only let out to shower or maybe exercise for a half hour or whatever. And they are not mixing with or interacting with other inmates. In some cases, the segregation actually becomes isolation that has almost been coupled with sensory deprivation. And in the extreme, the commission felt that it was just so clear from all the studies, from everything that we heard, that type of extreme segregation is so damaging that we shouldn't have that at all.
So it leads to mental health problems and maybe violence.
Yes. It leads to mental health problems, which then in turn leads to violence, not only for the individual, but also, again, for the officers who are working in those environments.
And why is this becoming more common these days?
Again, I mean, I think that it's a combination of things. It's a combination of the laws and how we're incarcerating and how we're using incarceration and why we're using it and the length of stay. Some of it is behavior management, that instead of addressing some of these other issues that we're talking about that we know affect the amount of violence and unsafe conditions, that in many instances segregation is being used instead of doing these other things that would decrease violence. And so I think there's a variety of reasons why that's occurring.
One of the things in the report that caught my attention was the frequent references in the text of how important it is for prisoners to be productive.
Right.
And actually, at first, I didn't even know what it meant, because I assume there's not that many jobs that one with which one could make money in prison. So what exactly are those who wrote that referring to, and how do you make people productive in prisons, and why do you feel that that's important? Why was it emphasized?
There are prisons that do have work programs and some that do not. And those who have them, it ranges all over from work programs that some of them have whole industries and things that are going on there where then large numbers of prisoners can work as opposed to simply doing prison jobs. So there's a range with regard to work. But I think what was most noticeable also to the commission was that long ago, prisons used to have things like GED programs and other sorts of training programs so that people left prisons more prepared, more employable, more educated, having developed some positive kind of work ethic and behaviors, all of which would help them function better upon their release from prison, that those programs have been just dwindled away, either due to budget cuts or due to the transfer of funds from those sorts of programs into just simply building new prisons to house more people and to hire more staff to watch them. And so that those programs have just dwindled and dwindled away. But it was also clear from all the studies that in addition to the fact that such programs help prepare inmates for their release, to give them more of a chance to be able to function upon their release, that having something to do instead of just kind of sitting around and looking at each other all day had an impact on the environment of the prison and in turn had an impact on things like safety and violence.
This commission developed a report with highlighting most of the issues we've discussed so far. And I guess I want to close by asking, what is it you'd like listeners who are interested or concerned about the issue, what did you really want people to do?
Well, I want people to recognize that what happens in prisons doesn't really stay there, that what happens to the men and women who are incarcerated, their health status, the experiences that they have there, do come back to us as a larger community in some sort of real way. And so acting as if they're kind of off, out of sight, out of mind, and out of reach, and not having any impact on the rest of us, and that by simply getting them away from us, we're somehow protecting ourselves, I think that's a false notion. So I'm asking listeners to recognize that. And once you recognize that, then you realize that you have an investment, too. Even if you don't know anybody in prison, you have an investment in what goes on in prison. And you have a reason to think about safety and abuse that goes on there, and that people who suffer from health and mental health problems need treatment, and they don't need to be exposed to more and more violence and abuse while they're there. What that raises then questions about is, do we support just sending more and more prisons, building more and more prisons, sending more and more people to prisons, and providing more and more dangerous and unsafe conditions under which they're going to be incarcerated? And I think that people need to speak out that this isn't working and we need to do something else.
Well, Richard Dudley, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Thank you for having me.
The report of the Prison Commission is available at the Commission's website, prisoncommission.org. On an upcoming airing of Public Health Radio, we'll take a look at an aspect of prison health not addressed on today's show, the privatization of prison health services. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.